Okay, well, before I start my talk properly, I'll make a quick announcement that Bob has asked me to make, which is that there's now an email mailing list for people interested in quantum foundations. I know many of you will already be a member of it. But if you're not, send an email to this address, which is on the board here, and you can sign up. And this is now regularly used to advertise jobs, advertise workshops, etc., in the area of quantum foundations. Okay, so... sorry, there's an address, not on the blackboard. It actually says quantum-foundations-subscribe@maillist.ox.ac.uk. Okay, so I'll start my talk properly now. I'm going to be talking about correlations, and in particular, how correlations can sometimes be thought of as doing computation. Looking within the frame of generalized FOIL theories, I'll be looking in particular at classical correlations, quantum correlations, and more general. Looking up at my subtitle there, I apologize for the slightly dodgy grammar that seems to have crept into my slide there. This work, I'm going to summarize and give an overview of several results which are joint work with these people here who all at some point have been working with me at University College London. Okay, so the latter part of the title of this workshop was FOILs for Quantum Information Processing. And I think in particular in today's session, we're seeing ways in which ideas from quantum computing and quantum foundations start to come together. Now, my talk is primarily going to be about correlations. So the sort of FOIL theories which I will consider are theories in which the correlations are defined in certain ways and studied. I'll explain what I mean precisely by correlations in a few slides, but it's basically very similar to what's been introduced already by, for example, Tony earlier in the week. So we have this, if we want to really sort of coarse grain all this, we can flatten down all these theories into sort of a spectrum. So on the one hand, we have classical physics that we understand pretty well, we hope. And on the other hand, we can consider very, very generalized theories where we really reduce the set of axioms which define our theories to very, very simple and small sets. So, for example, Boxworld, which I will introduce shortly, is basically defined by an axiom which says there should be no signaling correlations. But apart from that, it's not really specified at all. And then sort of sitting between these extremes, we have quantum theory. And we'd like to use these theories either side of it as foils to give better insights into quantum theory. And really one particularly nice example of this was given in the first talk by Gilles, where he showed that if, you know, along this line, if we didn't live in a quantum world but something slightly different, we'd get something which can be considered unreasonable behavior. So in particular, he looked at the problem of communication complexity of functions and showed that if we lived in a world where in a CHSH experiment, Cyrilson's bound was violated within this region here, then the communication complexity of arbitrary functions would be reduced to a single bit. Okay, and this seems quite implausible and is a good example of some of the unpalatable features which might occur in these theories. Boolean functions, indeed. I should have said that. That's very important. Okay, so a sort of a key role is played in this by the Popescu-Rohlik non-local box. And these sort of percentages at the top represent the, in some sense, the probability of exactly simulating a PR box within your theory. Okay, so if we can simulate the PR box too well, then this unpalatable thing occurs. Now, I want to sort of propose that we can literally start to think about the Popescu-Rorlich box as representing a computational device. So this was sort of my schematic of the PR box. We've seen it defined many times this week, so I'll do this quickly. But essentially, we have two objects, two boxes, which are space-like separated. We think of them as measurement devices with two measurement settings, which we label X1 and X2. So these are bits. And when we make our measurement, when we input X1 and X2 into these two boxes, we get back two bits, which have the following property. Their parity is equal to the product of the input. So if we were to take these two bits and plug them into an XOR gate, which I'm representing by this gray square here, the bit that comes out is the product of those. And you can see, if we start to think of this as a computation, it's a computation which has a variety. It's made from a variety of compound parts. We have at the end the XOR gate, which is a computational gate that we're very familiar with. But above it, we have something else. And this something else is the correlation. And taken literally, what the correlation seems to be doing for us, it's converting an XOR gate into an AND gate. So in some sense, this correlation is doing some computation for us. Now, that example is the Popescu-Rorlich box, which, as we know, does not arise in quantum theory. But we have similar examples which do arise in quantum theory, the most dramatic of which is so-called measurement-based quantum computation. And in measurement-based quantum computation, we take a single entangled state over many particles, and then we make single-qubit measurements upon that state, and we do some classical post-processing of those measurements. In fact, we need to make those measurements adaptively, which means we maybe will make measurements on these qubits, process the measurement outcomes, and then use that information to choose which measurements to make on the next set of qubits. So this is, again, a model where there are correlations, this time arising from measurements on a quantum state, and some extra classical computation, which is sort of playing a similar role to this parity, this XOR gate up here. And so in this example, we can think of the correlations provided by the measurements on this entangled state as boosting us from classical computation up to quantum computation. So again, the correlations are sort of doing something computational. Okay. So I'm going to use this to look at the correlations which arise in general theories. And in particular, I'm going to not restrict myself to just the bipartite setting, but I'm going to allow many different measurements. So in a very similar notation to many of the talks this week, I'm going to represent measurements by boxes. So each one of these boxes represents a measurement device, and the arrows at the top represent the setting, sort of the information, the classical information going into the box, and the arrow coming out of the bottom represents the output, the information leaving the box. And again, similar to many of the talks, I'm going to restrict the number of settings to two and the number of outputs to two. That means we can talk about all of the classical information in this model as bits, which simplifies the analysis greatly. In fact, we don't have to do this, and many of the results I'll talk about today can be generalized to the desetting setting. Okay. So if we assume that these boxes are all space-like separated, it's natural to want to impose a non-signaling condition, and that's what we're going to do, which loosely stated says that the choice of measurement here shouldn't affect the marginal statistics of the outputs for any of the other boxes. And this is a very well-studied theory. It's been a very well-studied setting. It's arisen a lot already this week. And we can consider the different correlations which can arise in this setting in different theories. So classical physics, where we, you know, we assume that these boxes are all satisfying a local hidden variable model, which means that they're all behaving classically, so they may share some random data, but apart from that, everything inside them is deterministic, and all the data is represented by real values. That leads us to a certain set of correlations, or we can study the correlations which arise in quantum theory, or as a sort of an extreme, we can consider box world, which I think was first sort of defined in this way by John Barrett and the name of generalized non-signaling theory. And in box world, we just say that all correlations are allowed, provided they don't lead to signaling. Okay, so we're going to study classical correlations, quantum correlations, and box world correlations. Okay, so I've already introduced the PR box as an AND gate, but I just want to talk again about how the non-signaling condition arises here and how it's satisfied. And the reason why the non-signaling condition is satisfied is that the marginal distributions of both of the outputs of the PR box is uniform. That means there can be no information about the settings in the marginal information alone. And the way we reconstruct the output of the box, this product of bits, is by performing an XOR gate. In other words, the output is encoded in parity. And this parity encoding, sort of on its own, guarantees that the non-signaling condition is maintained. If we demand that things are encoded in parity such that marginal distributions are always uniform, then the no-signaling condition is built in. And we see that whenever we do that, whenever we take this step, we're always going to need a post-processing element to convert this correlation into a computer. We can't simply say, okay, we're going to use our correlations, and the output of this first box will be the output of our computation. This would represent a signaling correlation for any non-trivial computation. So this means that in this model where we think of correlations as providing computational resource, there always needs to be some sort of classical processing involved which turns the output data into an actual computational output. Now, this may set alarm bells ringing because you may think, well, hang on, I'm claiming that these boxes are performing a computation, and yet I'm having to add an actual active computation with this XOR gate. And the way around this problem is to restrict the types of active computations which I'm going to allow in the model. And we can do this by recognizing that the XOR gate has a particular property of being a linear Boolean function, whereas the AND gate is a nonlinear Boolean function. And Boolean functions you're all familiar with is simply a map from an n-bit string to a single bit. And one of the nice properties of Boolean functions is you can describe them as a polynomial, simply working in Z2 arithmetic, where the addition is given by or represented by the XOR gate, and multiplication is represented by an AND gate. So any Boolean function can be written in this form. And that immediately tells us that if we have AND gates and XOR gates, we can generate all Boolean functions. And this nice polynomial approach gives us a natural way of defining linear functions. This is a standard practice in the study of Boolean functions. We define the linear functions as those functions which you can generate using an XOR gates alone. Okay? Or you might want to add a NOT gate to invert your output, but I'll ignore the need for NOT gates in this talk. Okay, and we can count the number of Boolean functions that there are, and a sort of a very brief analysis will tell you that we have 2 to the n plus 1 linear functions, but 2 to the 2 to the n Boolean functions in general. So there are a lot of Boolean functions. And you can then ask, well, can I find efficient circuits of XOR gates and AND gates to implement these functions? And this question, I think, was first asked by Shannon in the 40s, who was able to show by just a counting argument that the answer is no. If you just consider, if you have a polynomial number of these gates and consider how many possible Boolean functions could I construct, you find that it's much, much smaller than this 2 to the 2 to the n, which says that essentially for large n, almost all Boolean functions can't be achieved efficiently. So they would require an exponential number of gates classically. So there are a lot of these things. Okay. So I've given the PR box as one example of this sort of computation from correlation. My second example was measurement-based quantum computation, which I don't want to spend too long introducing. But I just want to outline some salient features. I mean, there have been a lot of reformulations over the years of this kind of computational model. But the original work in this direction was done by Rassendorf and Briegel 10 years ago. And their model can be represented schematically like this. So these boxes now represent measurements on quantum bits. But apart from that, they're exactly the same as our previous boxes. Each box takes a bit as an input and outputs a bit. So what that tells us is that in Rassendorf and Briegel's model, every measurement that's made is a dichotomic measurement, and there's always just two choices of measurement which you need to make. Okay? So you can then take a certain entangled state, such as a cluster state, and make single-qubit measurements upon it. And by choosing the measurements that you make, choosing the input settings of these measurements correctly, you can implement an arbitrary quantum computation. So this model over here is equivalent to the standard unitary circuit model of quantum computation. And there are several nice features about Rassendorf and Briegel's model. Perhaps the most surprising is that you can do this with a single state or a single family of states, the cluster states. But there are other interesting features. Firstly, you require adaptive measurement. So their model requires you to choose your settings over here after these measurements have been made and after this information has been recorded. And the third interesting feature is that, very similar to the PR box, the only classical processing that needs to go into this is linear. Okay? And the reason that this arises is, in this model, essentially what this computation is doing is processing Pauli errors, which arise, just like we can model errors in quantum computation due to external factors, we can model those as Pauli, using Pauli operators. Similarly, the randomness in these measurements leads to extra Pauli operators being inserted into the unitary gate. So what the computers are doing really here is counting Pauli operators. And if you think about that, as you multiply Pauli operators together, they're self-inverse, so you only need to count modulo 2. So linear processing is sufficient here in this model. There's also a model of measurement-based quantum computation, which doesn't really work, but it's something which I have investigated nonetheless. And this is a model where you take your ability to perform adaptive measurement away. We now say all of the measurements must be made simultaneously, which means that, well, some of them might depend on the inputs to our circuit, and others will be just measurements in fixed bases. So you may ask, what can you do with a model like this? Well, we haven't been able to show that this is a universal quantum computer, and it's almost certainly not a universal quantum computer. But it can perform some non-trivial computations. And you can show that it's actually very closely related to a circuit model of computation proposed by Mick Bremner, Dan Shepard, and Richard Joser, called the instantaneous quantum computer. So this IQC model is a model where, which is very similar to standard quantum computing, except that all of the gates you're allowed have to commute with one another. In other words, they all have to be diagonal in the Hadamard basis, so the basis, and they're all constructed by exponentiating Pauli X operators. Okay, so this is a model which you might think is trivial. It looks very simple, and certainly it's hard to construct algorithms in this model. But you can argue that this model is likely to be hard to simulate on a classical computer. And I won't go through the details of their argument, but one of the key steps in their argument is the fact that if we post-select on the outputs of our measurements, if I say repeat this computation many times, and I only sort of accept the output of my computation when I demand that these measurement settings here are all zero, sorry, these measurement outputs are all zero, if I make this post-selection, then I know in advance what these measurement settings need to be. Okay. So if I'm allowed to post-select and force certain measurements to take certain outcomes, I already know in advance what all of the measurement settings in my computation need to be. And so you can see that post-selection converts this instantaneous model of computation to the full model of quantum computation. So the two models are equivalent under post-selection. Now, post-selection has additional powers. This was investigated by Scott. And he showed that if you can post-select, as well as post-selecting these measurements here, but you also post-select on your output register of your quantum computer, then you boost the computational power of this thing up to a complexity class called PP, which is right at the top of the polynomial hierarchy. Now, if you consider a similar argument for a classical computer, a similar sort of promotion in computational power occurs, but it's not as far. It only takes you to the third level in the polynomial hierarchy. And so you can use that as the basis for an argument that these models are likely to be hard to simulate. Basically, if you could simulate them within multiplicative error, then this would collapse the polynomial hierarchy down to the third level, which is something that we don't expect. So this almost trivial model is in some sense has more computational power than classical computing. Okay, so that's my introduction. So what are we going to do with this? Well, very simply, we're going to consider this kind of effect, computation from correlations, in a range of different theories. So we'll look at it in classical physics. We'll also compare that with the quantum results that we know, and we'll also compare that with Boxworld. And we might ask, can we get any effect like this in classical physics whatsoever? Or, on the other hand, we may ask, if we generalize beyond quantum physics, at what point do we start finding unreasonable effects? What point do the correlations give us too much computational power? Now, usually we describe the computational power, our intuitive idea of computational power is best captured formally using complexity classes. But here, I'm not going to use complexity classes. I'm going to use something simpler, which is much easier to talk about, but also less powerful. And that idea is computational expressiveness. So what I mean by computational expressiveness is, what computations can a model of computing perform at all? Computational complexity, what does it do? It classifies problems by looking at a model, putting some restriction on a resource in that model. For example, we look at quantum circuits or classical circuits, and we restrict ourselves to a polynomial amount of time. And that defines a complexity class. On the other hand, we can take a computational model, and we can ask, well, what computations can it perform at all, without restricting any other resources? And if we do that, quantum computing and classical computing are the same. And in the language of Boolean functions, we can say that both of these models can compute arbitrary Boolean functions. If you give them unbounded time, of course they can do that. But this allows us to distinguish these models of computation from circuits only made up of XOR gates. Because as we've already seen, XOR gates alone can only generate linear Boolean functions. So in terms of expressiveness, we can distinguish the linear Boolean functions from the nonlinear Boolean functions. And that's very easy to do. This is full of subtleties and conjecture, and it's very hard to prove many results rigorously. Whereas proving that a nonlinear function is nonlinear is trivial. Okay, so it's much easier to make this separation. So as we've seen already, the correlations we want to consider will not, in general, be deterministic. So that means if we want to consider them as computations, we need to consider non-deterministic computations. That's all very simple. So we're going to consider, rather than Boolean functions, from our input to our output. We'll consider stochastic maps, which are simply maps from the bit to a probability distribution, representing, given input X, what's the probability that the output is 0, what's the probability that the output is 1. Okay? And, of course, both of those can be represented by a single parameter which ranges between 0 and 1. Okay? And we can take all 2 to the n of these parameters, and we can stack them into a vector, and then we have a very nice geometric representation of our function. So every function lives at a point in some 2 to the n dimensional hypercube. And this hypercube is the convex hull of our deterministic maps. This is something which has been, I think, remarked on several times this week, but if we take 2 deterministic processes and we allow convex mixing, these kind of geometric approaches, that literally gives you a point between those 2 deterministic maps. And if you consider all possible mixings, you just get the convex hull of these deterministic points. So as a very simple example, the unary functions on a single bit, there are only 4 of them, so I can represent them here, and here they are. We have the constant functions which output 0 and 1. We have the identity function, and we have the not function. And so all the stochastic unary Boolean maps can be represented as points in this square. Okay, when we generalize this to other numbers of bits, we simply go up in dimension to hypercubes. So what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce a series of models, and under the restriction that we're either looking at classical correlations, quantum correlations, or Boxwell correlations, I want to identify the expressiveness of that model. In other words, I want to identify the region in stochastic map space that that model can access. Good. So I'm going to do that with 3 models, very simple models, which will sort of build up in complexity. First one is this. We assume this is like a generalization of the PR box. We assume that all of our measurements are done simultaneously, and we're going to assume that the input of our computation, which is going to be a bit string X, is just fed directly into our boxes. So each box receives 1 input bit from X. And we're going to allow post-processing, but it has to be linear. And then we're going to look at the output. OK, that's the first model and the main model that I'll talk about. But then we'll see that it makes sense to start to generalize this model by adding extra things. In the second model that we're looking at, it's going to be the same idea as the first model, except for an additional ingredient. We're going to allow pre-processing of the data. So when our input bits come in, we're allowed to perform some linear computation on them and then send the output of those linear computations as inputs to our boxes. And the main distinction between this box and this model and the previous one is that this pre-processing allows us to have ancillary measurements. So here, the number of boxes is equal to the number of bits in our input string. Here, it can be greater. Okay, then the third model I'm going to look at also allows for adaptive measurements. So we're going to allow the output of these measurements here to affect our choice of measurement settings over here. Okay, so back to model 1. So this is what it looks like, and it should be very familiar to you. So X is the bit string that's representing the input to our computation, and the bits determine the settings for each of these boxes. Well, this is exactly the same sort of setup that we get in a Bell inequality experiment. Okay? In particular, generalizations of the CHSH inequality, where we assume that we have 2 settings per box and 2 output possibilities. And in fact, the connection with CHSH is even closer to that. You'll remember that the CHSH inequality is constructed from expectation values of products of the outputs, which represent the correlations between the outputs. Now, those expectation values, if we write them in terms of bits, can be written like this. Okay? We can just write them as the difference between the probability that the parity of the outputs is 0 and the probability that the parity is 1. Okay, so that's just a simple rewriting. And there you see that all CHSH type inequalities, which it were generally written as linear combinations of these expectation values, they're just telling you something about the probability that the output bit here, that the parity of all of these measurements is equal to 1. Okay, so we can immediately map all of the results for the generalized CHSH inequalities, which are normally done in terms of this parameter here, directly into the expressibility of a computational model. So let's jump directly to the work that was previously done. So this is 10 years old, done simultaneously by these people here. And they have found lots of nice results in this model. Firstly, they were able to completely identify the polytope of correlations which arise when you restrict yourself to local hidden variable theory. So this would be the classical model in the language that I've been using. And they found that this polytope has a nice geometric form. It actually forms a hyper-octahedron, which sits inside the hypercube of all functions. We know that Bell inequalities are violated, and sure enough, they find the quantum region, which can be described in a very nice closed form for CHSH inequalities. It sort of curves and bulges above this region. And of course, Boxworld inhabits the whole hypercube. Boxworld gives us everything. So where do Bell inequalities arise? Well, we've seen this already. Bell inequalities are simply inequalities which slice up our hypercube into two half spaces, one side of which all local hidden variable correlations are guaranteed to live. So in particular, we can take facets of our polytope, and we can use those to define Bell inequalities. I should point out that in this CHSH inequality, where you're only studying the statistics of the parities of the outputs, the polytope is much simpler than when you consider the full probability distribution. So in Valerio's talk, he showed how horrendous the local hidden variable polytope is, even for n equals 3. Here, in this setting, it's all very nice and simple and symmetric because we're only looking at the parity statistics. Okay, so now we're going to just take that and take those results and recast them in the language of computational expressiveness. Firstly, we'll do it for the classical model. Okay, so it's a classical model, so we can treat the analysis classically. It's all very simple. We have these boxes, and they're literally classical boxes, just performing one-to-one bit functions. And we can allow these boxes to behave stochastically, but that's just equivalent to the boxes behaving deterministically, but sharing some random data amongst them, which they use to drive their deterministic computation. So we can identify these functions just by looking for all the deterministic functions and then taking the complex closure of those functions. So what are the deterministic functions? Well, it turns out they're simply the linear Boolean functions. Why? Well, these single boxes are only mapping single bits to single bits, and all of the unary functions are linear. Then this box at the bottom, this is our computer which calculates the parity of all these things. This is also linear. So we can re-identify that nice hyper-octahedron of the local hidden variable polytopes as simply the convex hull of linear functions on X. Okay. So that's rather nice. It's a very simple and compact way of characterizing this thing. And we know immediately that all the extreme points of the polytope are just simply consisting of linear functions. And this immediately tells us something about the computational power of this model. We don't see correlations as a computational resource in the classical world. So we don't expect to be able to use them as a computational resource. And indeed, here you see that they're really contributing nothing to the computation. We can compute all linear functions, but really the thing that's doing the computation is this final step here. And all that our boxes are contributing is randomness. Okay, so that's really all that we get. That's not a negligible thing. I mean, randomness is an important resource in computation, but it doesn't really change the expressiveness. Sort of the key thing which is giving us our expressive power here is the linear classical computation which is going on top. Okay, so now we can look at the quantum region, and we see that, this model is exactly the same as the non-adaptive measurement-based quantum computing model that I outlined already. So the region of expressiveness of this model is going to be bigger because it contains non-trivial computations. And sure enough, we find that we have this nice bulge here. So we can associate these correlations here directly with the sort of computations achievable in this instantaneous quantum computing model. And it tells us some nice things directly. The fact that we don't have PO boxes tells us that this model doesn't support any deterministic nonlinear functions. And we can use these connections to sort of characterize one model in terms of the other. In particular, this region is fully characterized in the papers by Werner, Wolf, Sikorsky, and Bruckner. So that tells us straight away that how to characterize IQP. Let me move on to Boxwell, because this is a bit more interesting. Now, all of the correlations which can exist do exist, provided they're non-signaling. But you see, because we're encoding the output of our computation as a parity, that's all this post-processing is doing, that means we can encode any computation in a non-signaling way. We just enforce that all of the marginal probabilities are uniform. So that means we can actually encode any Boolean function in a non-signaling distribution. So Boxworld is incredibly powerful. It supports correlations which compute all of these 2 to the 2 to the n Boolean functions, and it does so in each case with a number of boxes which is simply equal to the number of bits, equal to n. And I've already remarked that these functions normally have exponential circuits classically. So you can see that Boxworld supports things, objects with vast computational power, which do represent a really big speed up over the classical implementation. And you can think of this as an analog of Van Damme and Broussard's communication complexity result. If we lived in Boxworld, all Boolean functions would have sort of trivial ways of implementing them. And we know that Boxworld has many, many failings, one of which is a lack of interesting dynamics. And David Gross, Marcus Muller, and several other of you here showed that if we want to have reversible dynamics in Boxworld, the only dynamics which can be allowed are trivial, in the sense that it just is sort of exchanging boxes, relabeling their outputs. But that doesn't actually change the computational power of these boxes. So another way of thinking about Boxworld is a world where all these super powerful oracles exist, and they all sort of float around, and eventually you can use them to perform a very hard computation. Okay, so we've seen that this sort of idea of considering computational correlations gives us a new way of looking at the CHSH inequality, a new way of characterizing the local hidden variable region in this very compact way, and yet another example of something crazy which happens in Boxworld. Now, the fact that the local hidden variable region is just a linear polytope is very useful. And it's more than just sort of a cute way of restating a known result. It means that it tells us immediately that we can generalize our model. For example, to model 2, by adding extra linear processing, and we're never going to change the expressive power of the classical correlation. So we can take classical correlations and we can add arbitrary linear processing, and the expressive power is never going to change. And that means all the Bell inequalities which are valid in the standard CHSH model are also valid in this model. So in model 2, we've added extra boxes and we've added this linear pre-processing. And this is like performing a CHSH experiment, but with a promise. The promise that some of the measurement settings depend linearly on the measurement settings chosen for other boxes. Okay. Now clearly, as I've argued, the classical region of expressiveness is unchanged. Boxworld will still be all-powerful. It already can do everything and remains all-powerful. So what about the quantum region? Does that change in this model? Well, indeed it does, because now we can include correlations which implement the GHZ paradox. So here it is, the GHZ paradox sort of written using my sort of visual language. These are the equations which define the GHZ state and which represent the GHZ paradox. The thing to notice, if you look at these operators here, is that the operator on the right is only an x when both of the operators on the left are the same, and when they're different, it's a z. So that can be rewritten as follows. The measurement setting for this box has to be equal to the parity of the measurement settings of these boxes. And similarly, you can see that the equations imply that the parity of the outputs is equal to the product x1, x2. Okay, so that's a GHZ paradox. It's just like a non-local box extended to three parties, really. It's just, in this language, it's the same. Okay, so that's the GHZ paradox. Can we generalize this? What about the multi-party setting? What about other functions? Well, it turns out we can. We can do this for all Boolean functions. So that's slightly surprising because there are so many of the Boolean functions, but you can show that this works for all of them. All you need is a m-qubit GHZ state, which looks like this, and then very similar to the standard GHZ paradox, equatorial measurements suffice to give you output statistics such that the parity of these measurement outcomes is equal to an arbitrary Boolean function on the inputs. So we can do that with 2 to the n sites. So we require exponential number of sites, which is good. If we didn't, we'd think something was wrong because that would be giving too much power to quantum mechanics. We don't expect to be able to express all Boolean functions in an efficient way in quantum mechanics. So, as I said, the exponential size compares nicely to the exponential circuit size in classical physics. And you might think, well, maybe there's a possibility of some quantum speed up here nevertheless. There isn't, because this entire process can be mapped in a straightforward way to a computation with a single qubit. In fact, the trick that goes into this is basically just analog computation. So it has also some issues regarding fault tolerance. But in terms of just showing the existence of correlations, we can indeed show that correlations exist, which can compute all of these functions. Okay, so we can use this to derive Bell inequalities, and there's only a slight tweak we have to make. Usually we write Bell inequalities like this. We normally express these expectation values in terms of a certain measurement setting. So here we've got measurement setting 0 and 0, and those correspond to measurement settings of a particular box. Well, we can slightly generalize that and simply say that we're going to express CHSH inequality, CHS-type inequalities, using this input bit x. So now we can express, we just write our E of x rather than E of the measurement settings. And when we do that, because we've still got this linear polytope, we know that all of the Bell inequalities that were valid in the standard CHSH case get mapped over to here. So, for example, this CHSH inequality now also includes the case where we have arbitrary linear pre-programming here, which means that the CHSH inequality directly implies already the Merman inequality. All of these things are sort of aspects of the same inequality. So in one way of looking at this is by allowing this pre-processing, we're sort of collapsing down the Bell inequalities and coarse-graining them and identifying them with each other. Of course, we know that the Merman inequality is maximally violated by quantum mechanics, and that, again, is a reflection of the fact that we can achieve all nonlinear functions deterministically in the quantum region. Now, this superpower of the quantum expressiveness that we've now seen, the fact that we can get all Boolean functions, may seem as a problem if we want to distinguish quantum mechanics from box world. So, fortunately, all we need to do to resolve this is just recognize that in any experiment, the number of measurements is fixed. So when we fix the number of measurements, m, we no longer can access all of the functions. And the distinction between quantum and Boxwell comes back. And for example, if we set m equals m, we go back to the traditional CHSH type inequalities. Okay, so I have a third model. I don't have very much time, so I'll skip over this. The third model basically just says, okay, well, now we're going to add this sort of adaptivity here. Again, everything is linear. So we remain within the linear polytope. So again, the same CHSH inequalities apply here, even though there's, in some sense, signaling. And of course, the quantum region is boosted because rather than being represented by IQP circuits, the quantum region can now be represented by arbitrary quantum circuits. So that means model 3 has a bigger quantum region. So what would be nice is if you could see this transition from model 2 to model 3, which in some sense represents an increase in Bell inequality violation, if you could do that in an experiment. But you might say, well, this is clearly impossible to do in a Bell inequality experiment because we have adaptive measurements. And in a Bell inequality experiment, our measurements have to be space-like separated. But this can be resolved using the fact that the hidden variable region is the linear polytope. We simply go back to this, and we see that, everything's linear in this model, so there's nowhere for linear non-linearity to squeeze in. And this sort of adaptivity, the dependence of this setting on this output, can again be faked by post-selection. We can simulate it using post-selection. And then because we're simulating this exactly, then the previous argument about linearity just goes straight through. So we can implement post-selection where we only choose data where this measurement setting here is equal to this measurement output here, and we don't cause any loopholes. We don't change the space of the local hidden variable region. So there is an experiment you can do where you take all your data, then you do this particular filtering, and the Bell inequality violation increases without causing a loophole. Now, I have to say there's a caveat to this, or several caveats. The first caveat is that this, I'm only comparing model 3 and model 2 here. It doesn't really make sense to compare model 3 and model 1 directly, because in model 1, we weren't allowed to have ancillary boxes. So the number of boxes was equal to the number of input bits. Nevertheless, if you take model 2 as a straightforward generalization of model 1, then you can say that this sort of post-selection allows you to boost Bell inequality violations without causing loopholes, without changing the local hidden variable region. Okay. So that's the end of my talk. I can summarize everything I've been saying on this slide. This is only sort of, a footstep into studying the computational power of general theories, because most of the interesting things are going to happen down here just beyond quantum physics. And all we've looked at so far is this area right over here. So Boxwell, unsurprisingly, had insane computational power. Classical world, perhaps also unsurprisingly, didn't contribute very much computational power in this model. Whereas quantum sort of sits like Goldilocks nicely in the middle. Okay, so as there are many open questions, firstly, one thing which might be nice, and we haven't tried this yet, would be to extend this work from single output bits to considering the full output number of output bits. This would be basically looking at the complete probability distribution. And this is this is the region where we know the polytopes become very complicated. They're imposing the no signaling condition leads to rather asymmetric and complicated polytopes. And maybe this sort of approach can be used to sort of simplify or a way of simply expressing these polytopes. Can we go to a broad range of theories? Really, it would be nice to sort of come down here and look analogous to what Gilles and co-authors did with communication complexity. And we can certainly do that for a small region around Boxworld. This is a very information theoretic thing. We've looked at computation in these models. Can we then turn the question on its head and find information theoretic principles which tell us, for example, why one would expect the quantum correlations to allow you to achieve all Boolean functions, but only with this exponential cost? We've used this expressiveness. Part of the reason why we did that is because complexity theory is hard. And it's much more difficult to cast these problems in a rigorous way using complexity theory. And yet, there seem to be hints of complexity theory in there. We had this exponential scaling that we worried about. So using proper complexity theory to tighten up some of this reasoning is a good possible way forward. And finally, I've presented some things which are quite aesthetically pleasing, and certainly it's a very nice reformulation of the CHSH inequality in this language. But is there a killer app? Is there something which this approach allows us to do that other traditional approaches fail to do? So far, we don't have it. So, you know, we have nice results, but I don't think a killer app which says that this is the way you have to understand the CHSH inequality. Okay, I will finish there. Here are some references, and thanks very much for listening.
Are there any questions, comments for Dan?
So you said that in quantum mechanics you cannot get a deterministic evaluation of a nonlinear function.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that quantum mechanics can essentially be probabilistically simulating non-trivial ones? So it's definitely a
yes.
Nonlinear function, but you just don't know which?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that statement is equivalent to the existence of Bell inequality violations. So Bell inequality violations means quantum gives you something which lives outside the polytope of linear functions.
Oh, but I mean, lives outside but also has no component. You can express it as having no component that's a linear function.
You can't really talk about components in that sense, I think. So we're talking, it's hard to really sort of say, you mean sort of write down a convex decomposition where it's impossible to add any linear terms?
Well, even just a convex combination that's only of nonlinear terms.
The problem is the decompositions of these things are not unique. So I'm not sure whether you can do that, but it might be possible.
So I didn't quite follow the connection with this work that you presented by David Gross and Marcus Muller, in which they show that,
mm-hmm.
If you want to allow reversible computation, then,
yes.
then everything is trivial. But I don't know if they kind of argue then that they would not be useful for computation, but then you kind of argue in the opposite direction. And I don't know if you could elaborate a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, what this really shows is the conflict between box world and the classical world. In the classical world, where it's easy to do linear computations, for example, when you combine that with box world, then you get this ridiculous computational power. But if you were somehow to constrain yourself to something, I mean, it's difficult because box world is not really a self-contained theory. But if you somehow were to define your ability as a classical observer to be constrained by being able to be embedded in Boxworld at another level, then you wouldn't be able to reproduce classical physics. I guess it's sort of a no many worlds for Boxworld theory. I guess you could interpret it that way.
And you think this could change with if you look at the approach of complexity? So all these things you said, if you were looking at the complexity...
Yes.
Approach, then you think that the results would change dramatically, or do you think same things would kind of apply?
What I think the adding complexity might do would be help with this kind of question. It might give you, because, you know, you could say, it might be reasonable to, I mean, you could take, for an example of an information theoretic principle could be the generalized Church-Turing thesis from Deutsch. And then you could say, you know, if there's something in your theory which gives you computational power beyond BQP, then, you know, use that as a way of limiting correlations. And it's clear that the correlations must be limited by that principle. So that's the sort of thing you could investigate.
Thank you. So we thank Dan again.